Real Man by Hugh Masekela. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. This week, we will be talking about the meaning of Marcus Garvey with Lee Shaw and Earlene Anthony. But first, we have on the line Miss Judith Bowman, one of the co-producers of the Veterans Corner, and we'll be coming back to Judy in a minute. Judy is a co-producer of a section called the Veterans Corner, in which we will be reading from the book Bloods by Wallace Terry that deals with the history of the African-American involvement in the Vietnam War. So I would like to start off by reading a section from Bloods, and it is the section that deals with one of the soldiers during this particular time, Specialist 5 Harold Lightbulb Bryant, who was a combat engineer in the 1st Cavalry Division, U.S. Army, February 1966 to February 1967. When I came to Washington to see the Vietnam Memorial, I looked through the book and there were about 15 guys from my hometown who were killed, and six of them I knew. But I looked up the memorial for James Plummer first. Plummer was a black guy from Cincinnati. We were the same age, 20. We were at Camp Alpha together. That's where they assign you when you first come to Nam. I was in C Company, a line company. He was a truck driver. So he was in headquarters company, where they keep all of the heavy equipment. I like Plummer's style. He was so easygoing. We sit down and just rap. Rap about music, the girls, what was happening in the world, get high. Plummer was a John Coltrane fan. And I being Miles Davis fan, we just automatically fell in with each other. He was my best friend. One day we were at the airfield at the LZ. Plummer was out of the truck over by the ammo dump. And the ammo dump received a mortar round. It blew him up. It freaked me out. I mean, that here I saw him and 5 minutes later he instantaneously dead. Me and two other guys ran and grabbed what we could. We pulled on the jungle fatigue, which was full of blood. It looked like maybe a dog after it crossed the street and got hit by a truck. His head was gone, both his legs from about the knee down were both gone. One arm was gone, the other was a stump left. We finally got his trunk together. The rest of it we really couldn't find because that one mortar round, it started the ammo dump to steady exploding. It constantly blew up for about an hour. What we found was probably sent back to the States. They probably had a closed casket funeral. I kind of cried. I was saying to myself that this was such a waste because we weren't really doing anything at the time, and him just being such a nice fellow, why did he have to go this way? Go in pieces. Everybody knew that me and him was tight. So a couple of guys took me up over to the bunker and we rapped about him all night because we were out in the bush and I really couldn't get no booze. But when I did get back, I brought me a half gallon of gin and I just knocked it off. And that didn't make me feel any better. When I got back, I called his mother. His mother knew me from him writing to her. I told her I was close by when he did get killed. I just told her an ammo dump blew up. I'm pretty sure she didn't have no idea what that was. Every year I sent her a Christmas card. I just signed my name. When I saw Plummer on the memorial, I kind of cried again. I guess deep down in my head, now I can't really believe in God like I did because I can't really see why God would let something like this happen, especially like to my friend Plummer, why he would take such a good individual from here. Before I went to Vietnam, I was very active in the church because of my mother's influence. She sent me a Bible and I carried it in my pocket everywhere I went. When I couldn't find any Playboy or something like that, I would read it. Matter of fact, I read it from cover to cover, starting from Genesis. I guess I got kind of really unreligious because of my Vietnam experience. Oh, I went to church once in my uniform to please my mother, but I haven't been back since except for funerals. I talked to chaplains. I talked to preachers about Vietnam, and no one could give me a satisfactory explanation of what happened overseas. But each year I've been back, I've read the Bible from cover to cover. I keep looking for explanations. I can't find it. I can't find it. And this is from the book Blood, the testimony of Specialist 5, Harold Lightbulb Bryant. Okay, now on the line, we have Judith Bowman, who is one of the co-producers of this section of the Veterans Corner. How you doing, Judy?
I'm good, Melvin. How are you?
Oh, so glad. Glad to hear your voice. Now, hey, Judy, can you tell us a little about the relationship between the Tuskegee Airmen and the African-American soldiers in Vietnam? What was they thought about what was happening in Vietnam?
Sure. Well, you know, my dad was one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, and my memory of the 60s is that my dad was military all the way, even though he retired at the beginning of the 60s. By the time the war here in this country, you know, was being debated back and forth, my dad really didn't speak too much about Vietnam with his kids. I had a brother, and my brother was at Wilberforce Central State,
mm-hmm.
one of the historically black colleges at the time. And, you know, my dad wasn't pushing my brother to go. My brother clearly was not going to go. And so a lot of young black guys at that time, I think, were looking for exemptions. You know, Black is Beautiful was the reigning sentiment of the time. And I don't think there was anything about the Vietnam War generally for people that were, you know, felt a need to be doing something positive for the race. I don't think there was anybody that really wanted to enlist you know, from that circle of black young undergrads. So my brother, I think, was prepared to do what some of his friends did, and that was go to Canada, get married, look for something that was going to prevent them from having to go. Flat feet was popular. wet the bed was another one that some young men a figure that they would use to avoid going to the war. So between the younger generation and my dad's generation, there wasn't much conversation about it, I think, because we respected my dad's and the other Tuskegee Airmen's military service, but times were changing and there was a different philosophy. There was a philosophy that if no one in Vietnam had attacked anybody in the black community, then why should the black community be over there, you know, killing people that had never done anything against them?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was sort of my narrow, you know, view of it as a teenager growing up during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say that my dad's attitude was, you know, universal, because, you know, obviously there's a whole range of philosophies and, you know, sentiment throughout each race. But most of the men that, you know, came over to talk with my dad, they didn't say anything against the young people that were protesting, but they certainly weren't like cheerleaders, you know, urging people to go. I think they understood that a torch had been passed and nobody disrespected them for their service, and yet they were not, you know, preaching that young people needed to go to the war. But they were too respectful of their country and of the president at the time to say anything negative
about it. Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, Judy. Now, in your research for your play, the 101 Club, do you see similarities in what the Tuskegee Airmen face and what the African-American Vietnam soldier face?
I'm sorry, did you say the last part again? I'm on a cell phone, sorry.
Do you see, in your research for your play, the 101 Club, do you mm-hmm. see any similarities in what the Tuskegee Airmen face and what the African-American Vietnam soldier face?
Well, my play is about World War II and young men about the same age as Lightbulb, the young man whose story you read from just a bit ago. And, you know, I loved your reading. I think, you know, if we could put ourselves in the mode of a 19, 20-year-old young person, either the ones that had enlisted early on in the war, or the ones that were being drafted. You know, once they got there, I think what I have found is that there was a high degree of dedication to the military purpose. You know, the statistics, I think, show that in Vietnam, certainly more black young men were being killed than numbers represented in general. So if there were 9, 10, 11% black draftees in Vietnam, I think the statistics show that people being killed were, black people being killed during that time were about 23%. So, you know, they were being killed almost at a rate twice as much as what their numbers would have shown statistically. For my dad's peers, they were young. You know, they were fighting perhaps for the first time, not, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the enemy, so to speak. My dad was a navigator, and so he was, you know, flying in the sorties that those men were doing from North Africa, from Tripoli,
mm-hmm.
over to Europe during that time. And you know, there weren't as many casualties because they weren't just right there, you know, doing hand-to-hand combat. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, mm-hmm. but that's some of my thinking about it and some of the research that I've done so far for my play.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Judy, thank you very much. Judy Bowman, one of the co-producers of the Veterans Corner, and we're looking forward to when we can have you in the studio again.
All right, Melvin, I look forward to it, too. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Judy.
Bye.
Okay, Judy Bowman, she's one of the co-producers for this section, the Veterans Corner, and we're reading from, well, we just finished reading a section from the book Bloods, by Wallace Terry, an oral history of the Vietnam War by African-American soldiers. And we just read the a portion of the story of Specialist 5, Harold Lightbulb Bryant, who served in Vietnam from February 1966 to February 1967. Let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we'll come back and discuss the meaning of Marcus Garvey.
This is the community calendar for the month of August. Every Tuesday from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., the Veterans Community Theater Workshop is being held. The location is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard. This is near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. And if you're traveling by the Metro bus, the number 60 and 66 stops right at the corner. For contact information on this event, 323-850-4436. On Sunday, August 19th and the 26th, from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m., the award-winning Actors Co-op Theater Company is accepting submissions for company's memberships, and also auditions will be held. This is on August 19th and the 26th. The upcoming seasons includes The World Goes Round, and Then There Were None, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, The Miracle Worker, and The Matchmaker. For submissions, please email or send your headshots, resumes to acoauditions@gmail.com, attention auditions committee. Submission deadline is August 17th. The Unusual Suspect Theater Company is seeking playwrights, actors, and dancers. They're seeking mentors for writing and performance workshop will be with the middle and high school students in the Los Angeles area. Contact information on this is Joyce Lee, Senior Program Manager, 617 South Olive Street, Suite 812, Los Angeles, California, 914. Telephone number 213-488-8488, extension 207. Or you can email her at joyce@theunusualsuspects.org. And if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, just send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And once again, our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Thank you, Earlene Anthony. We're back with the Qumran Report. Joining us for our discussion of Marcus Garvey is community activist and actor Lee Shaw. Lee, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you, Melvin.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into our discussion of the meaning of Marcus Garvey, especially since Marcus Garvey's birthday is coming up this Friday, August the 17th, he was born August the 17th, 1887, and he died June the 10th, 1940. I would like to read just a little information from the Wikipedia about Marcus Garvey. He was a Jamaican political leader, publisher, journal, and orator who was a staunch proponent of the Black nationalist and Pan-Africanism movement, to which in he founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association. He also founded the Black Star Line, part of the Back to African movement, which promoted the return of African diaspora. Prior to the 20th century, leaders such as Prince Hall, Martin Delaney, Edward Blyden, and Henry Garnet advocated the involvement of the African-American Back to Africa movement. Garvey was unique in advancing a pan-African philosophy to inspire a global mass movement and economic empowerment focusing on Africa known as Garveyism. Promoted by the UNIA as a movement of African redemption, Gobbyism would eventually inspire others, ranging from the Nation of Islam to the Rastafarian movement, which proclaimed Gobbi as a prophet, the Rastafarian movement. The intent of the movement was for those of African ancestry to redeem Africa and for the European colonial powers to leave it. His essential idea about Africa was stated in an editorial in the Negro World, which was the organ for Marcus Garvey, where he wrote, "Our union must know no claim, boundary, or nationality to let us hold together under all claims and in every country." Okay, with that, let's start our discussion of Marcus Garvey. First of all, let's start off with a discussion of what does Marcus Garvey mean to you? Let's start off with Lee, and then I'll go to my co-host, Earlene Anthony.
Well, seeing that Marcus Garvey, listen to what he said. His movement was the beginning of a new era. It was supposed to be the beginning for a new era for black people in America and then around the world. And this power in the United States and in other countries, seeing him as a threat, right? That's, you could, and they stopped it. They stopped it. They killed this world movement. You know, he's like a birth of a newborn era, a breath of fresh air for the black people, especially here in America. And I often wonder, even now, 53 years out of slavery to Marcus Garvey starting his movement, 96 years from Garvey to today, what would we have been if he'd have been allowed to continue and pass this thing on down? I say to most black people, you don't know what you know until you sit there nice and quiet to yourself and think, you know, because I would have been able to just jump on me an airplane and go to Africa and not have to worry about no passport, come back here and do business and go over there and do business, you know. We would have been in a better shape today than we would have than we are. See? And because people had insight and knew, kind of looked into the future, that he posed a big threat. You know, he posed a big threat. And so like I say, Marcus Garvey to me means a breath of fresh air. I'm very grateful to have studied about him. Even to learn his speeches and things, because I'm still researching and thinking about him and going in and digging up more information, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay. We're going to get into him a little deep and dig deep into the teachings and the life of Marcus Garvey. But let's go to Ms. Earlene Anthony.
I didn't know a lot about Marcus Garvey. I probably still don't. But when we did the play about Marcus Garvey called Catch the Tiger, and I played Amy Ashwood Garvey, his first wife, I learned quite a bit of information about some of the things that he did, setting up the the Universal Negro Improvement Association, setting up newspapers, many other things he did. And like many people, he seemed to be a trailblazer ahead of his time with a lot of ideas. And he put a lot of his ideas into practice. He didn't just talk about them like a lot of people do. He did a lot of things for the Negro people at that time, and I'm sure it's still doing a lot for the Negro people of today, if you want to call them Negro people, African Americans, whatever we're called by now. But his works is still doing a lot for the blacks up today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the Tiger, we did the play Catch the Tiger. The Tiger was the code name for Marcus Garvey that J. Edgar Hoover used in the FBI files. Also, now let's talk a little about the Back to Africa movement, because when you think about Marcus Garvey, for those who discuss and know about Marcus Garvey, or when they do teach something about in high school, this is some of the points that they would talk about Back to Africa. What are your thoughts, Lee, on the Back to Africa concept that Garvey was talking about?
Well, when they say Back to Africa, most people just drop it right there, Back to Africa. He thinks that everybody want to go back to Africa. You know what I'm saying? There's some of us who would have liked to went back to Africa. Not if we wanted to stay there or not, but it was more economic than anything else. Because we want for ourselves. We want to do for ourselves. I don't want to look for a handout from nobody, especially if I can do it myself. You know, and in this country, they breed welfare. I mean, there's people who need welfare, but they breed it welfare right here in this country because the black man was always able to handle his own business, to do for himself. You know what I'm saying? Crippling people. This country is known for crippling people. And as far as African Americans are concerned, they had to fight every race of people it is that came to this country. They was always put on top of them to smash them back down so the other one on top could keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So when Marcus said back to Africa, you got to think back to Africa to do business with Africa. Like I said before, we don't know what we know.
Mm-hmm.
Our people have been sitting in this hole, right, on this rock for 200 some odd years before that even happened, right? We learned a whole lot. You take that, what we learned. You take the building, everything that we learned, and you take that back over into Africa, and you build Africa up.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think that God is racist. They'll tell you he's a racist, but I don't believe that's so. I believe that God pulled us up out of Africa, up under this horrible situation for us to redeem Africa, because Africa was lost once it came in. But if going back to Africa with the economics to build Africa up, you know what that meant? You know what that would mean? Mm-hmm. That means that everything that's there now from the other countries would not be there today.
Mm-hmm. The exploitation.
The exploited. Yeah, because this American Negro, black man, African-American, you know what I'm saying, and which none of these names we ever ain't named ourselves,
mm-hmm.
right? He was always given to you. You like to say, they used to say Hispanic, now he's calling himself Latino. That name was given too. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? We could have went there and built Africa following what Garvey has set up.
Mm-hmm. So basically what he was talking about is connecting, using Africa as the center point.
That's right.
For all of the people who have been taken out of
taken
Africa
out of
and
it.
Found themselves in different parts of the world now, South America, here, et cetera, like that.
You know, today we have so many professional people in this country, African-American people. Black people in this country. If, for instance, if Africa would have been in the same shape mentally, right, there would be no need for us to go back there. There would be no need. But he foresees things way into past our understanding. And so we are scattered here in the Western Hemisphere, right?
Mm-hmm.
To save a country that our ancestors came from. They knew it. They knew what he was talking about,
mm-hmm.
and he had to be stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So when they call, they say, back to Africa. No, not back there. I just said back to Africa. Back to Africa economically to build Africa up. Mm-hmm. See, because right now, everybody in there owns something except for the Africans.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the most amazing thing about the Back to Africa movement is at this particular time, one of the major enemies of Marcus Garvey was Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah.
And it's the irony of the whole situation is that Marcus Garvey never had a chance to even put his foot on the African, on the land of Africa over there.
Mm-hmm.
And Du Bois at the time, being a major enemy against this, in going back to giving up his American citizenship, going back to Africa and Ghana, working on the Encyclopedia Africana, and that's where he's buried at today. Let me ask you something else, because we're going to get into this a little deep. Let's talk about the influence of Booker T. Washington. Let's see, what do you think the influence of Booker T. Washington on the thoughts of Marcus Garvey?
Self-help.
Mm-hmm.
To do for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? This is one of the reasons why he come here, to work with Booker T. Washington.
Mm-hmm.
See, anytime that somebody tells you, man, I can show you how to help yourself, I'm all ears.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I don't care where it is in the world, I can show you how to help, you know, self-help. Because like I said, don't nobody want to be dependent on nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? But in this country, they make you dependent on it because they snatch everything out from the bottom of you. And I don't talk about my people and to make them feel bad. But we got short memories. We need to think some. We need to hold. You know, one thing that God blessed the human being with is memory. In Islam, they might say dhikr, mm-hmm. right? To remember.
Mm-hmm.
See, so we need to remember these things. We need to stop just. You know what? I was thinking on my way over here. I haven't heard nothing about Trayvon Martin in a while. See, short memory. Short memory of this cold situation, but short memory. Don't even talk about him no more.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
It's just a phase.
Yeah, we push and then we give up. And this is what happened. This is what happened. You know, from Marcus Garvey, those who followed him, right, were taking pieces and keep moving. And when we reached the 70s, right, everybody went crazy. There's no more struggle, right? Everything's all right now. No, man is created in toil and struggle. He's created for that.
Mm-hmm.
He's always gonna have to struggle. This ain't no lay down world. I can just lay down and breeze on across till mm-hmm. my death. You're gonna struggle. You're gonna have hardship. So you might as well keep on going while you're going,
mm-hmm.
and don't forget. Because if I walk 5 feet across this room here and fall in a hole, come back here next week, and don't remember that hole's over there, guess what's going to happen?
Fall in.
Right back in it again.
Yeah.
So, and this is what we do. You know what I'm saying? And I don't like to say this, but, you know, but this is what we do, though. For a lot of us, we do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to stop. You know what I'm saying? We need to stop. We need to go back. Go back to Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. You know what I'm saying? We need to go back to the Huey P. News and find the correlation between what happened then up to this particular point.
Mm-hmm.
Because after that point, everybody stopped struggling. Everybody got too cool. I want to be Superfly. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I'm the Mac Attack. I'm the Shaver.
Let's go into, and feel free to chime in at any time, Ms. Earlene. And we're really going to get into the discussion when we start talking about the two Amys. Mm-hmm. It's wise. But before we get into that, let's talk about the relationship between J. Edgar Hoover and Marcus Garvey. How did he fit into
the devil from the bottomless pit? Yeah, he's a shrewd man there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he knew, like I say, he knew what was going to go down. And he loved his country. He loved his countrymen. This is J. Edgar Hoover. Anything that opposes or anything that come in that don't fit the American way, you got to go. And by any means necessary. You know what I'm saying? They tried to kill him. But when they tried to kill him, they didn't try to kill him themselves. They put one of those, I call them two-bit weakening Negroes up to do that right there. You know what I'm saying? To try to hurt him. Right? But then, you know, Hoover, being a smart man, I am never taking nothing from him. Clever. Recognizing that Marcus Garvey wasn't a citizen of the United States. It's easy to do that right there. All I got to do is lock him up for a while until I figure out what to do with
him. Frame him for a crime.
Yeah, so I can figure out what I can do with this joker.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Hopefully he can stay locked up a while, but mm-hmm. that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So now, got to hold him long enough to get him up out of here.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Let's lay a little foundation for why J. Edgar Hoover is so important when it comes to Marcus Garvey. Because this was the first major case for J. Edgar Hoover as a young man when they brought him from Washington, D.C., sent him to New York to neutralize Marcus Garvey in the Universal Negro Improvement Association. So J. Edgar Hoover had to come up with some kind of plan. And the plan that he came up with was known as the concept of infiltration and disinformation.
Yeah.
And it works this way. He would take an individual, a very sharp, intelligent individual, in most cases, well-educated individual. So when he put him inside of these movements, he would rise up
in the ranks. Yeah.
You know, in the leadership position. And Hoover studied the movement from the inside to find out the weakness, the strengths, the little power play that you have on inside of these movements. And then this is called the disinformation process to play them off against each other to keep the movement from achieving their overall objective. And this concept became, Hoover later on, when he really became powerful and headed up the FBI, he used this as the counterintelligence program. He did, and when you think about it, he developed this from the time of Marcus Garvey, and he had it ready. Damn. But when the 60s came along,
moved on.
He was ready for it. He had 40 years of jump on all these so-called revolutionaries that thought that they understood what was happening. And he had infiltrators in all of these particular movements.
Yeah.
And this counterintelligence program became known as COINTELPRO. Now, what Hoover did with Marcus Garvey, he took the infiltrator that he used, was known as Confidential Informant Number 800. This is the one after the Freedom of Information Act, when they were able to get to all of the papers and stuff, the whole Marcus Garvey papers and stuff, and the correspondence, this is what they found out. Confidential Informant Number 800, who was inside of the Marcus Garvey movement, reporting to a detective named Agent Amos, who was one of your few black African-Americans, but it was a lot of black African-Americans who worked with J. Edgar Hoover. This is why a lot of people say J. Edgar Hoover was racist, but J. Edgar Hoover had a deeper mission than little small things like racism. He worked with a lot of African-Americans to achieve his goal. And so this is, and what do you think about that? What we're dealing with this whole concept that he used to bring down the Panthers, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X.
If we look at starting from Marcus Garvey and all these informants, they rose in the ranks, and most of them were number two or three men. They were somewhere in the ranks. They was close to the leadership. You know what I'm saying? So they were able to have input, some type of input. Right? And most of the time, it was something far away from where they should have been going. You know what I'm saying? So, and knowing exactly what the plan was and feeding this information to somebody else, feeding it back to Hoover, right? It's like, I know what's going to happen before it happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I know where it's going to.
Mm-hmm.
So now all I got to do is set it up to where it's a roadblock right there for waiting on you.
And when you think about what he was able to do almost with the ideal situation of using this concept of infiltration and disinformation that he used on to split up Malcolm X and Honorable Elijah Muhammad. You know, at that time, neither one understood what was happening.
Yeah.
You know, and the undercover, the infiltrators that they had so close to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and close to Malcolm X.
I mean, close to all of them. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So, and again, I say our memory, we shed it off. We don't like to remember those things because now moving into the part, moving into, to, say, the late 60s, starting with, say, the latter years of Martin Luther King's movement, on into the Black Panther Party, right?
Mm-hmm.
If memory would have been right, We would have been looking for that confidential informant of that day. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? And looking for him, you could have flushed him out of there. You see, I got this thing about what I like to do is I don't too much, I listen to what people have to say. But I'm not finna start taking advice from somebody I just met yesterday. You know? Mm-hmm. And I say this because they moved through the ranks. And not just with the late 60s, but even into this so-called gang-banging era. Right? These cats don't even know who was moving in the ranks with them. Because he said, I'm from home on Wong, right? You take that as solid gold. And at the same time, he worked for some law enforcement agency.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And we ought to go do this and we ought to go do that. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? You kind of want to know who you're dealing with. Especially, I say the homeboy syndrome, the homeboy thing. If you came up in the community I came up in, and I've been knowing you, say, for 40 years, and you've been consistent about what you do, then I might be able to take something from you and kind of trust you. You know what I'm saying? Especially when it has nothing to do with money, because you're putting yourself out there to help your people. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to be some money involved, we know that they kind of bends people a little bit. You know what I'm saying? They might turn on you, may not. But most of the time, when it's movement and ain't dealing with no wealth, then you can move on.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Because one of the things that they used, the Hoover technique after the death of Hoover, to split up gangs like the Crips and the Bloods, who at one time just the Crips was the Crips.
Yeah.
Bloods. And then the infiltrators come in, split them up into so many different warring pods to keep them from achieving anything but killing each other. You know,
since we're talking about Crips, I remember the day when the brothers would say, Crip here, right? And as it got to be a whole bunch of little splinter groups, then they put this thing Crips, right? But the thing was not Crips. It was Crip. That's all. No S's, no apostrophes, no nothing. Just Crip. You know what I'm saying? And this is just like anything else that you could take and say, okay, I'm Hispanic today. In 10 years from now, I'm Latino. You know what I'm saying? Researching one with the other. So now I make the whole, if I say I'm just Hispanic, that leaves out my Latin heritage. Nobody's going to shoot that far down the road. Uh-huh. But to make me more stronger, let's give them the name Latino. And that'll push us all the way into Rome.
Keep them from connecting to the Spanish language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, you really go around that. So when they get into, I often wondered about the term, what do you call it? Angelino. Isn't that something that the Italian people or Latin people, Latin word? Mm. Angelino?
You talking about Los Angeles?
Yeah, they call it Angelino.
I know the root word can be all traced background to dealing with angels. And
Los Angeles, the name of the city, Los Angeles.
City of angels. Mm.
You know, I mean, just, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. See, and when we go back to Garvey and the structure, right, and those who followed his structure, we find that they were successful, especially Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He was successful, but only so far, right?
And he got away from it
when self-help, right? And those who remember the Whiting Fish. I think it came out of Peru. And this government, again, intervened on self-help. We got enough fish over there. You ain't got to sell him. We got to ship no fish to him.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Broken down.
Yeah, broke all that down. See, because mm-hmm. this is a country that want to keep you on welfare. No, not just on welfare, on their welfare.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Amy Ashwood Garvey and Amy Jock Garvey, who was the two wives of Marcus Garvey. Amy Ashwood Garvey, she was born January the 10th, 1897. She died May the 11th, 1969. Amy Jock Garvey, December 31st, she was born 1895. She died July the 25th, 1973. And it's amazing that they outlived all of the Reverend Malcolm, Martin Luther King, et cetera.
I mean, to see
Let's go to Earlene and have some comments on that.
It always amazed me that Marcus Garvey married both wives was named Amy. There must be something with that. Yeah. But Amy Ashwood Garvey and Amy John Garvey was friends. And Amy Ashwood was actually training Amy Jock to be a part of the UNIA and, like, I say secretary or administrative assistant. And that's actually how Amy Jock came into contact and met Marcus Garvey. Amy Ashwood did a lot with the UNIA. She organized a section of the women called UNIA. She was instrumental in the Negro World newspaper. She also had a jazz club, and she did a lot of cabaret and things like that. And this is amazing. She also campaigned for Adam Clayton Powell Jr. And I thought that was interesting because, boy, being born in the 1897s, and she lived a long time. Matter of fact, she died in 1969. She was the age of 72. So it was a lot of information, interesting information about the two Garveys in there.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Amy Jock, who lived a long time, 1973. I think she was 88. And, and another person that I don't want to forget, this person, because he's, to me, it's hard to discuss Marcus Garvey without discussing Ducey Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yeah.
Because Ducey Muhammad Ali was the mentor of Marcus Garvey. The slogan, Africa for the African, came from Ducey Muhammad Ali. And also, when Garvey lived in London, he learned the whole concept about the newspaper business. And this is when he added a very important component to the organization, which you mentioned a little bit earlier, the Negro World, as a means to connect with the people, with all the little different sectors and stuff like that. At this time, I would like to do a reading. We're going to come back with a few more comments, but I would like to do a reading from Marcus Garvey. I'll do the introduction, and we're going to do a few of the speeches of Marcus Garvey with Lee Shaw. Now, one of the most powerful men in the United States in the last 100 years was J. Edgar Hoover. He would create plans and techniques to deal with the gangsters, the radicals, the communists, and just about anybody else he considered to be a threat to the American way of life. But before any of this could happen, J. Edgar Hoover was given a mission of utmost importance. What was that mission? It went by the name of Catch the Tiger. And who was the Tiger? The Tiger was the code name for Marcus Garvey.
Ethiopia shall soon stretch out her hands to God. If Europe is for the European, then I say Africa for the African. Where is the black man's government? Where is his king and kingdom? Where is his president, his country, his army, his navy? I could not find them anywhere, so I declared, I will help to make them. If Europe is for the European, then I say Africa for the African. It is time for a new way of thinking. We must begin to think for ourselves and do for ourselves, a new way of doing things. We need programs that really help our people. We have reached a time when every minute and every second must count for something done, something achieved in a cause for Africa. We need the freedom of Africa now. At this moment, I see Ethiopia stretching forth her hands unto God, and I see the angel of God taking up the standards of the red, the black, and the green, saying, follow me. If Europe is for the European, then Africa shall be for the black people of the world. We say it, we mean it. I've just come back from a 38-state tour in order to study the condition of the black people in America. Let me tell you what I found in this year of 1916. I found that the Negro Leagues of our people have no program. They're just living off their so-called leadership while our people continue groping in the dark, looking for a little light. Why are these so-called leaders so dependent upon the support and goodwill of the white men? The so-called Negro leaders of our people seem willing to turn back the clock of progress at the whim of their white support. It is indeed a pleasure for me to send a message of love to you at this time, when you are all so anxious to learn of my condition. I say to you that all is well. I am not sad because of my confinement, and I hope that you are not thinking thus of me. I have been the victim of a frame-up, a conspiracy, not only engaged in by members of the opposite race, but including selfish and jealous members from my own. I have been framed and sacrificed because of prejudice and the political and organizational designs of my enemy. I desire that you be peaceful and loyal in your assembly, and I take this opportunity to return thanks to you for the splendid interest you have manifested in me during the trial. And now, I commend to your care and attention my wife, Amy Jacques Garvey, who has been my helpmate and inspiration for years. She has suffered with me in the cause of service to our race, and if I have any sorrow, it is that I cannot be by her side at all times to protect her from the evil designs of the enemy. But I commend her to your care and intent in keeping, and feel that you will do as much for her as you have done for me. I feel sure that a day will come when the whole world will know the story of her noble sacrifice.
Okay, Mr. Lee Shaw reading from the speeches of Marcus Garvey. And this coming Friday is the birthday of Marcus Garvey. He was born on August the 17th. And also this coming Saturday at Leimert Park, in the celebration of Marcus Garvey, we will be performing speeches of Marcus Garvey, Drama Stage Qumran, with Lee Shaw and some of the other actors. And we'll be performing at 2 o'clock. So come on out and hear some of the speeches of Marcus Garvey and share this celebration of Marcus Garvey. Now, what I'd like to do at this time, let's have some closing comments about Marcus Garvey. Let's start with Earlene.
Well, just sitting and listening, I've learned a lot of information about Marcus Garvey that I didn't know before. He's truly was a statesman. For his time, and I say our time, good example for what the black race should be doing even today. And as Brother Lee said over there, what he started shouldn't have stopped. It should continue on, because his ideas was much before his time, but they're still good for our time. And I just wanted to just say I was glad to be a part of the Marcus Garvey stage play and to come in contact with such information, because I know a lot of this we didn't get in high school or colleges, black history teachings. There wasn't a lot of that. So it's good that we can talk about it today.
Okay, Lee.
Yeah. You know, when you look at leaders such as Marcus Garvey and his UNIA special, if we look at it as a whole, it was for us. And we should never let anybody come in and tell you part of the story and not all of the story. So your leader, if he be Marcus Garvey, or he be the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, or any of those, you need to understand something. You choose your leader not because he got a big fat pocket, and not because he want to have a big fat pocket, because he loves his people enough to go all the way out. And that's why I love Marcus Garvey for that, because it wasn't about a dollar. You know what I'm saying? The dollar what turns people corrupt. But the love for your family, your community, and your people as a whole, ain't nothing can beat that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he brought.
And then that's the amazing thing about a lot of the teachers and stuff who tried to portray Marcus Garvey as being greedy and mail fraud and all trying to make all that kind of money and stuff. And but you're right, Marcus Garvey was definitely not about money. Quickly, in the next about 30 seconds, what would you say is the message for Marcus Garvey for young people of the day, especially around here in this Los Angeles area?
One, unity. Help yourself and help your people, right? Because I believe, and I think this Martin Luther King guy, he said that if you can't find nothing to die for, then it ain't worth living.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And ain't, I don't find nothing in the world to die for more than my people. I love my people, but sometimes I don't think my people love me. But I love y'all, though. I love you, though. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And, you know, it's
okay. All right. Thank you, Lee. I would like to extend a special thanks to my in-studio guest, Lee Shaw, my co-host, Earlene Anthony, on the line with Judy Bowman and the Veterans Corner. And please check out our shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, skitrow.la, and dramastage-qumran.org. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. And I leave you with the song that opens the show, Colonial Man by Hugh Masekela.